Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, February 15th, 2022. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Does Horseshoe Run in Red or Black? Debate goes beyond numbers, as Prude makes comments to about county official, by Stuart Doreen. Quote, I didn't have to do anything to the auditor to make her change the numbers. She actually changed the numbers to make it look in the red. Unquote. That was Randy Prude's comment in front of a packed room at Midland Country Club during the Midland County Republican Women's Monthly Luncheon on Wednesday. Prude was talking about horseshoe operations expenditures and revenues, and he, for at least a second time during his campaign for re-election, stated on the record his concerns with County Auditor Veronica Morales and the numbers she was providing about the horseshoe. Immediately following the meeting, Prude denied saying Morales changed the numbers. However, less than 2 hours later, when confronted with the quote from a recording of the meeting at the Midland County Republican Women's Facebook page, Prude sent a text to the Reporter Telegram that said, quote, She did not change the numbers. I was incorrect in that statement. She changed the format, leading to a very disingenuous result, unquote. Multiple county officials told the Reporter Telegram after the MCRW meeting Prude was and has been incorrect in his comments about and toward Morales. Terry Johnson, the county judge and chief financial officer for the county, came to the defense of Morales. He said that he wanted to stand up for the county auditor. He described Prude's behavior as, quote, bullying and harassing, unquote. Another county leader, one not involved in primaries this year and who hasn't been part of the numerous horseshoe conversations over the years, is County Attorney Russell Malm. He approached the Reporter Telegram about making comments on Morales' behalf. He heard about the MCRW comments and was copied on emails between Prude and Morales. I have worked closely with Midland County Auditor Veronica Morales for over 15 years, Malm wrote. Every county official relies on Veronica because they trust her honesty, integrity, and professionalism. People can argue about what numbers mean, but any report Veronica prepares accurately and truthfully reports the correct information. In the email exchange between Morales and Prude, which were copied to members of the Commissioner's Court, a district judge, the county attorney, and the Reporter Telegram, Morales states, I feel removing certain horseshoe numbers would be deceptive to the readers of the financial statement. These numbers are in conformity with generally accepted accounting principles, which require that capital outlay in governmental accounting be included with the governmental funds. Prude's response included, You have already put out your version. It's not your business to tell me I can't have what I am asking for. Prude is running for re-election as the county commissioner of Precinct 4. His challengers for the Republican nomination are Diane Anderson and Charles Hall. The Democratic Party will not field a candidate for its primary, so it appears the winner of the GOP primary on March 1st will represent the precinct. Early voting began Monday. Precinct 4 has been a competitive race, and the horseshoe, specifically the yearly operations, has been an issue. In general, candidates for commissioner's court seats this campaign season have been consistent that the horseshoe is a community asset. There has been some back and forth about the contract with the operator, but the only real debate about whether the multipurpose complex in South Midland has run in the red or black involves the candidates in Precinct 4. And Prude has been defiant that the horseshoe has run in the black. he has been equally vocal about the facility's impact, including stating on multiple occasions that Walmart wouldn't have built a superstore on the south side had commissioners not decided to build the Horseshoe Arena, the first building constructed at the complex. The arena is now home to livestock contests and ropings, among other events. A little-known fact that most Midlanders don't know is that Walmart was in contact with Judge Mike Bradford, waiting to see if we were going to pull the trigger on the horseshoe construction, Prude wrote in an op-ed. Once they knew it was a go, they decided to build their new Walmart on the southeast location in Midland. So, does the Horseshoe Complex, which includes the arena, pavilion, amphitheater, and education building, run in the black? Prude says that happened 6 out of 8 years from 2012 to 2019. He provided the Reporter Telegram the Horseshoe Facility income statement, which shows the following income made during that 8-year span. $265,733 in 2012, $305,943 in 2013, $385,326 in 2014, $28,177 in 2016, $164,293 in 2018, and $74,109 in 2019. The numbers provided to the Reporter Telegram by Prude, the Horseshoe Facility income statement, show total revenue from 2012 to 2019 was $12.806 million, and that 65% of that total came from the hotel motel tax charged on those spending time in hotel rooms across Midland. The statement shows that the hotel-motel tax collected during those years totals $8.337 million, including $1.61 million in 2018 and $1.398 million in 2019. The other 35% of revenue includes the county's share of advertising, concession, and rental facility revenue. The use of hotel-motel tax to balance the books is at the heart of Prude's argument that the horseshoe runs in the black. Prude also disputes the listing of capital expenditures as a reason for whether the horseshoe runs in the red or black in any particular year. This was the point of contention in his email exchange with Morales from late January. Morales: Attached, please find the horseshoe income statement for your review. I have received several requests from you and the media regarding this information. I have included the construction cost of all horseshoe major buildings at the bottom of the report. These construction costs are not included in the income statement. Please feel free to contact me if you have any questions. Prude: Please resend this group the horseshoe report without the CapEx included for comparison. Morales: What is CapEx? Prude: Capital expense. Morales: Capital expenses are those expenses that fall above our capitalization threshold, which was previously $5,000 and is now $10,000. These are direct horseshoe facility operating expenses. For accounting purposes, we categorize them differently in order to make sure we capitalize those assets. But these expenses, merely because they are over $5,000, should not be removed from an income statement, as they are part of the operational expenses of the horseshoe facility. I have excluded the capital projects from the operational expenses, and those totals are listed separately at the bottom of the page. Prude: I still want the report. Morales: I have provided you with the numbers that you need. I cannot accommodate your request to remove expenditures out of this report. I feel removing those numbers would be deceptive to the readers of the financial statement. These numbers are in conformity with generally accepted accounting principles, which require that capital outlay in governmental accounting be included with the governmental funds. I have added one note to the bottom of the statement, which includes all of the small projects included with the Midland County Horseshoe Crew Room project, which Commissioner Luis Sanchez was requesting clarification on. Prude. I am asking for a profit-loss report that any CPA or accountant can present. You have already put out your version. It's not your business to tell me I can't have what I am asking for. You already sent me a profit-loss statement 2 years ago, which I need updated. What do the numbers Morales provided to the Reporter-Telegram indicate? The numbers are the same, except the Horseshoe Facility income statement for fiscal year 2012 through 2021 includes capital outlay expenditures. From 2012 to 2019, $3.325 million was spent on capital outlay expenditures, an average of $415,687 a year. If capital outlay expenditures are included, the Horseshoe Complex would have run in the black 4 out of 8 years between 2012 and 2019, but only one time between 2015 and 2019. The largest deficit would have taken place in 2019, $1.586 billion. Construction costs are not included in either statement. Total construction costs of the Horseshoe Arena, $12.898 million. Horseshoe Pavilion, $30.666 million. Horseshoe Amphitheater, $2.023 million. And Horseshoe Crew Room, $5.98 million, was listed at $51.568 million. Prude said the difference in the two statements provided to the Reporter-Telegram are the differences in a profit-loss statement and a consolidated statement. And the listing of capital expenditures appears to be that difference. This article is entitled City: Fatalities, Injury Accidents Up in 21 by Stuart Doreen. As Midland opened up after the COVID restrictions of 2020, so did the number of accidents with injuries and fatalities on roads inside the city of Midland. The city's 2021 traffic crash report was released Monday, and it showed an increase in fatalities, 23, the second most in the last 20 years. In 2014, there were 24, according to the city. The total in 2021 is 11 more than 2020. The city also reported 814 accidents with injuries, a 3% increase over the total in 2020. The total in 2021 was still 31.3% less than the total in 2019, 1,186. The total number of reported crashes in the city was virtually unchanged from 2,620 in 2020 to 2,691 in 2021. Those 2 years are the lowest going back 20 years, according to the city. Overall, traffic volume counts taken throughout the city in 2021 increased 12.3% compared to 2020 counts at the same locations, the city reported Monday. Other takeaways from the report included: the location with the highest number of reported crashes in 2021, again, was the interchange at Loop 250 and Andrews Highway, as in prior years. There were 79 crashes there. Loop 250 and Thomason Drive was second with 37 crashes. Loop 250 and Midkiff Road and Midland Drive and Andrews Highway were tied for third, 34 crashes each. 8 of the top 10 high crash locations, by crash rate and not the number of collisions, in Midland are interchanges on either Loop 250 or the interstate. As expected, the high crash locations identified each year generally represent the highest volume intersections within the city limits, the city noted. The most crashes took place during the month of October, 281, including 91 injury accidents. There were 146 injuries reported from those 91 accidents. October also was the month for the most fatal accidents, 5. There were 5 people killed that month. Overall, 23 people died in 23 fatal accidents in 2021, according to the city. Traffic volumes provided in the annual report represent one 24-hour period of data collection that occurred during that year, the city reported. Due to variations in daily traffic patterns, great care should be exercised in determining trends by comparing counts between multiple years at any specific location. This article is entitled, Governor, State Added More School Funding into Education During 2019-2021 Legislature Sessions, by Stuart Doreen. Governor Greg Abbott brushed off a pair of questions about how multiple school districts in the Permian Basin are sending a combined hundreds of millions of dollars to Austin to be redistributed to poorer school districts across the state. The school finance system is often referred to as Robin Hood, and since the 2013-14 school year, the state of Texas has captured more than $671 million from just Midland ISD. The annual payment has topped $137 million each of the last 3 years. Other contributors include Pecos Barstow Toya ISD reported on its website that its $106,052,955 recapture payment made up 69% of total expenses. Stanton ISD's 2021-22 original budget calls for a recapture payment of $19,052,902, which is around 55% of local, state, and federal funding. Glasscock County ISD, Garden City, spends around 70% of its budget, or $32 million, on its state-mandated equity transfer. The Texas School Coalition reported on its website in August that recapture has been on a sharp rise in Texas. Over the last 5 years, the amount of money in local funding that school districts have been forced to send to the state has nearly doubled, from $1.57 billion to $2.98 billion. Abbott was in Odessa on Monday for a Get Out the Vote rally. The governor answered a question after the rally about if property owners across the Permian Basin are going to get a break, saying the state has added more school funding into education during the 2019 and 2021 sessions. We added more school funding than may have ever been added before, including money for teacher pay raises, Abbott said. Then, on top of that, if you look at the American Rescue Plan Act funds that were distributed, there was well over $10 billion sent directly to school districts across the state to make sure that those schools have money to be able to respond to the issues that they're facing right now. Abbott also said, "We're going to make sure that every school is going to have the money that they need with this additional funding that we provide." Will the state provide more money and reduce or eliminate recapture payments? The governor didn't say. This is the Community and Nation page. This article is entitled "Fidget Lap Quilts is Group's Latest Labor of Love," by Iris Foster, Midland Reporter Telegram. There was a labor of love occurring at St. Luke's United Methodist Church on Saturday, and it involved members of Midland's Quilters Guild. From 9 a.m. until 3 p.m., 8 women gathered to construct fidget lap quilts for residents at Legacy Ranch Memory Care. A large Sunday school classroom and another remodeled space turned into a sweatshop full of donated sewing machines on cutting tables, surrounded by tall shelves of material, tubs of notions, multiple irons, and ironing boards. Fidget quilts, you ask? With assorted fabric, bits and pieces from sewing kits and craft drawers, bound quilts of about 12 inches by 18 inches became activity mats for zipping, buckling, buttoning, ripping, and mashing Velcro, stuffing pockets, braiding ribbons, counting beads, and petting fur or fleece. While the fabrics and tasks differed slightly among quilters, the goal was the same: brightly colored backgrounds with engrossing hands-on work. Cindy Lanning, chair for this project, was asked to provide about 20 of these quilts for those at Legacy who, like her mother, need things to keep their minds active and their fingers busy. A local neurologist explained that anxiety is a common companion to Alzheimer's disease, and fidgeting is often a manifestation of that anxiety. Lest you think this workshop was comprised of docile little old ladies, nothing could be further from the truth. CPA Kathy Lupardis prepared the go-by fidget quilt, and even though this is tax season, she's been quilting for a while because she said, "I do left brain stuff at work, so I've got to have some right brain activities." Both accounting and quilting involve lots of math and precision, she adds. All of the ladies were loving the fun aspect of this project because their work did not have to be as precise as actual quilting. Kathy Hassel, a former kindergarten teacher, has been quilting since 1995 and even opened her own business, Aunt Kathy's Quilts and More, 3 years ago. She specializes in t-shirt and memory quilts, along with memory teddy bears. Her sister, Carla Roth, a 20-year quilter, joined in the fun Saturday while on vacation from her career as an overseas consultant. No stranger to a sewing machine, she even made her daughter's wedding gown years ago. That caused Pam Thompson to reminisce about making her two daughters' prom dresses. Interspersed with her 20-year quilting hobby are years of donning leather and fringes, mounting her Harley, and taking off for Sturgis, South Dakota, as well as the back roads of Texas with her husband. You might still find her astride her hog if her husband hadn't sold his, which left her with no one to ride with. Other ladies stitching Saturday were also multi-talented. Former Mississippi resident Becky Greenleaf has only been quilting for 7 or 8 years, but she is very dedicated, saying she had finally turned off her sewing machine at 10:30 p.m. the previous night. Her background includes a career as a school counselor, work in a quilt shop where she demonstrated Bernina sewing machines and promoted the embroidery business. Vicky Sachs, a fifth-generation Midlander, is an EOG retiree and the mother of three, including an MPD officer. Her motivation for attending the workshop, besides the camaraderie of the group, was to honor her mother who died last October from Alzheimer's. Brandy Padgett, also a native Midlander and member of St. Luke's, may be the newest member of this group, which normally meets at the church on Tuesdays. She claims she was adopted by this family when she brought a 90-something client with Alzheimer's to the weekly gatherings. Assisting that lady who loved quilting made it an easy choice for her to continue after the client died. Lanning learned to quilt via a class at Midland College, which still offers quilting, in 1992 while she was executive director of Keep Midland Beautiful. She's the organized one, who was chairing the annual quilt show at Bush Convention Center in October, where ladies offer their work for sale. In the meantime, guild members hand-sew quilts of varying sizes for nonprofits in Midland. One special project involves red, white, and blue 60-inch by 80-inch 80 quilts for veterans of at least 6 months of active service who are nominated by friends and relatives. To nominate someone, please contact Phyllis Price at 432-230-0884. The group makes quilts for Habitat for Humanity's new homeowners, for Hospice of Midland, for Allison Cancer Center, Midland Rape Crisis and Children's Advocacy Center, The Field's Edge, and for clients of Midland County Child Welfare Board. Each December, they make quilted placemats for Meals on Wheels recipients. Saturday's fidget lap quilts could be considered one-of-a-kind works of art. Or they could just be expressions of love from ladies whose talents with needle and thread expand their giving hearts. This article is entitled, P&Z Approves Tikala's Plan for Second Location, by Mela McEwen. Tikala's is cooking up a second location, and its efforts have received the go-ahead from the Planning and Zoning Commission. The Commission unanimously approved, with one abstention, a request for Tikala's, which operates a restaurant at 4610 North Garfield, for a specific use designation with term for the sale of all alcoholic beverages on premises consumption, in a restaurant at 3322 North Loop 250. The building had been divided into three separate businesses, including Freebird's World Burrito and La Haiba, both of which had closed. Gomka Family Restaurants, the company that operates Tikala's, will convert the three into one suite of 6,924 square feet with an alcohol serviceable area of 3,935 square feet. Proposed hours of operations will be 8 a.m. to midnight daily, with alcohol service each day from 8 a.m. to 1 a.m. the following day. Commissioners also unanimously approved plans to develop a neighborhood retail strip at 2801 East Highway 80, which is just 350 feet east of Green Acres Mini Golf, and a Dollar General retail store. Lewis Clay had requested a zone change from AE, Agricultural Estate District, to LR, Local Retail District, to develop a 21,000 square foot building to house various types of local retail businesses to serve the surrounding neighborhoods. This particular property's frontage would require approximately 22 trees, depending on exact street footage. Finally, commissioners unanimously approved James Griffey's request for a zone change from SF2, Single Family Dwelling District, to PD, Planned District for an Office Center, on 8 lots at 1606 North A Street, in order to develop a mini-storage facility. Griffiths told commissioners the storage facility was seen as a low-impact use of the lot. Elizabeth Shaughnessy, planning division manager with the city's Department of Development Services, explained to commissioners that since the project did not meet Tall City Tomorrow requirements, the staff had not recommended approval or denial of the request because they wanted commissioners to have all the facts before making a decision. If approved, the development would need to conform to Section 5.05, Non-Residential Zoning District Dimensional Regulations, and Section 6.01 through 6.05, Zoning Development Regulations of the Zoning Ordinance. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, Permian Oil Output Sets Record Again, by Sheila Taubin, Bloomberg. Production from America's Permian Basin reached a record high for the third month in a row in January, as a red-hot price rally keeps shale drillers busy. Crude supply from the basin, which includes Texas and New Mexico, averaged 5.06 million barrels a day in January, surpassing the 5 million mark for the first time in data going back to 2007, according to the Energy Information Administration. The agency expects volumes to grow through March. Permian output continues to exceed every OPEC member except Saudi Arabia. Production is set to climb even more, with oil prices at a 7-year high, spurring oil explorers to pump away. The basin has recovered the most quickly from the drop in oil output that ensued when the pandemic hit because of its low production costs. It is spearheading growth in American oil output, while other shale regions lag. The EIA also reported continued recovery in other shale fields. January volumes in the Eagle Ford in South Texas reached the highest since September, while North Dakota's Bakken output was at the highest since December 2020. Supply from the seven major shale regions reached 8.49 million barrels a day, the highest since March 2020. The previous record for Permian output was set in December. The agency also revised its November volumes higher, surpassing a long-time record set in March 2020. Despite the steady growth in U.S. supply, the world is in a deficit as demand recovery speeds along, while OPEC Plus is failing to meet its quotas. Total U.S. oil output lags pre-pandemic highs seen just before prices plunged in 2020 and forced explorers to slash output. The surge in output comes amid simmering geopolitical tensions between Russia and Ukraine that have pushed U.S. crude futures to $95 a barrel for the first time since 2014. This article is entitled, Oil Jumps to $95 as Price Rises on Ukraine Tensions, by Julia Fanzeres, Bloomberg. Oil jumped as simmering geopolitical tensions between Russia and Ukraine kept the market on edge and volatility high. West Texas Intermediate surged above $95 a barrel for the first time since 2014. Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky spooked markets with what appeared to be a sarcastic comment about the rest of the world predicting a date for a Russian attack. Russia has denied it plans to invade, and its foreign minister said he would propose to continue diplomatic engagements with the West. A potential Russian invasion of Ukraine could not only disrupt crude supplies, but also could spark retaliatory sanctions by the U.S. With a lack of clarity on the effect on oil and incredibly low inventories, the market is definitely worried here and buying, said Scott Shelton, energy specialist at ICAP. The situation is entering a potentially decisive week. Russia could take offensive military action or attempt to spark a conflict inside Ukraine as early as this week, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Friday. Russia has amassed troops near the Ukrainian border, though Russian President Vladimir Putin has repeatedly said his country has no plans to invade its smaller neighbor. This article is entitled, U.S. Crude to Help Set World's Most Vital Oil Price from 2023, by Alex Longley and Sherry Sue, Bloomberg. U.S. oil is set to be added to the world's most important crude benchmark from the middle of next year. Crude from Midland will be added to Dated Brent for June 2023 cargoes, its publisher S&P Global Platts said in a proposal on Monday. It follows a 12-month period in which one plan to reform the North Sea oil benchmark was quashed after market uproar, and in which one of the biggest oil traders in the world voiced concerns about what it called regular dislocations in prices. While the proposal isn't a final plan, it indicates the most likely path ahead. Any further major changes that require long delays could be a risk to the benchmark as supply from the North Sea dwindles. In contrast to its initial plan last year, Platts will now largely keep the existing terms of the Dated Brent benchmark, but will make a series of technical changes to allow for the inclusion of U.S. oil. We have received a lot of input from the industry, said Vera Bly, Global Director of Oil and LNG Markets at S&P Global Platts. There was firm agreement that Brent needs to evolve, and actually a firm commitment from the industry to work with Platts. Platts had also been consulting on the prospect of adding crude from Norway's giant Johan Sverdrup field, but that was dropped from the latest proposal. Its heavier, more sulfurous supply makes it a tricky match for Dated Brent, which is generally the opposite. Last year, the price publisher put forth a similar plan, although it proposed to fundamentally change the terms of Dated Brent by adding the cost of freight, among other things. That drew criticism, notably from the Intercontinental Exchange, Inc., which hosts a suite of derivatives tied to the benchmark, including Brent oil futures. We look forward to continuing to work with Platts and the industry on further developing this proposal from here, ICE said in a statement Monday. Our goal throughout has been to facilitate a discussion with market participants covering all the key issues which need to be addressed to further strengthen the Brent complex for decades to come. This article is entitled OPEC Chief: Focus is on Keeping Markets Supplied, by Salma El-Wardani, Bloomberg. OPEC is focused on keeping the oil market well supplied, even as the group continues to grapple with underinvestment, according to its top official. There is no doubt that we are concerned with ensuring that the security of supply is also guaranteed, OPEC Secretary General Mohamed Barkindo told reporters on the sidelines of an energy conference in Cairo. The group and its allies are working to ensure that we continue to be reliable and dependable to supply oil to global markets. Despite steadily reviving halted production, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries has struggled to meet its supply targets largely because of lack of investment. Some, such as Libya, are also struggling with internal unrest. Those shortcomings, combined with geopolitical tensions in Eastern Europe, have helped push oil prices higher, Barkindo said. Brent crude earlier on Monday rose above $96 a barrel, the highest intraday level since 2014. In a report published last week, OPEC said global fuel use could grow by more than the 4.3% that it's currently projecting for 2022. If demand continues to grow at the group's projections, quote, the world will continue to be thirsty for oil for the foreseeable future, unquote, Barkindo said. This article is called Oil in Brief, and it is from Bloomberg. IEA head urges OPEC Plus laggards to boost output to balance markets. OPEC Plus members producing below their crude output quotas need to pump more to balance oil markets, said International Energy Agency head Faith Birol. Oil has rallied to a seven-year high above $90 a barrel as demand rebounds and global supply lags behind. While the 23-nation OPEC Plus alliance agreed to raise output targets again at its last meeting, the group is struggling to fulfill its pledges. Producers from Nigeria and Libya to Iran are falling short of their targets. Increasing production from the U.S., Canada, and Brazil hasn't been enough to ease high energy prices, Birol said at a conference in Cairo. Tensions between Russia and the West over Ukraine are also putting upward pressure on crude prices. The U.S. has said Russia could soon invade Ukraine, while Moscow has repeatedly denied such an intention. Europe's natural gas crunch and surging prices are due to an artificial tightness in the market, said Birol. The politicization of the gas sector is not in favor of anyone, producers or consumers, he said. This article is entitled In Brief by Stuart Doreen. Quake rattles northwest Midland County. A 3.0 magnitude earthquake took place Monday afternoon inside Midland County, northwest of the city and north of Craddock Highway. The quake took place around 5:29 p.m. and at a depth of 3.1 miles, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. EarthquakeTracker.com reported Monday that the quake was the second in the past 7 days in and around Midland County. The site also showed 21 quakes in the past 30 days, and 256 quakes in the past 365 days. This is the obituary column, Tuesday, February 15th. Bessie Lidke. Bessie Lidke, born the 20th of June 1925, left this world on the 8th of February 2022, peacefully at her home in Houston with family by her side. Preceded in death by her parents, Alfred and Laura Smith of Austin, her husband, Bill Lidke. Bessie is survived by her four children, Billy Lidke, Laura Buchholz, Cadell Lidke, and Claire Alexander and their spouses, 12 grandchildren and 18 great-grandchildren, her brother Murray Smith, and a world of wonderful nieces and nephews and cousins. A memorial service to be conducted at 11 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday, the 16th of February, in the sanctuary of Memorial Drive Presbyterian Church, 11612 Memorial Drive in Houston. Those unable to attend may join the live stream of the service accessible by visiting Mrs. Lidke's online memorial tribute at gohlewis.com and selecting the Join Live Stream icon. In lieu of customary remembrances, the family requests with gratitude that memorial contributions in her name be directed to Houston Arboretum and Nature Center, 4501 Woodway Drive, Houston, 77024. Or the Corbett Medical Foundation, P.O. Box 343, Saratoga, Wyoming, 82331. Or to First Tee Greater Houston, firstteegreaterhouston.org, or the charity of one's choice. Charles H. Dodd, November 27, 1950 to February 3, 2022. Reverend Charles H. Dodd, 71, passed from this life into the arms of Jesus on Thursday, February 3, 2022, at home. Visitation with the family will be Wednesday, February 16th, 5 to 7 p.m. at Wilkinson Hatch Bailey Funeral Home. Reverend Paul Sands will officiate a celebration of Charles's life on Thursday, February 17th at 2 p.m. at First Woodway Baptist Church. Charles was born in San Angelo, November 27, 1950, to William Herring and Dorothy Virginia Hall Dodd. He was preceded in death by his parents. Survivors include his wife, Jan Dodd of Woodway, son Ryan Dodd and wife Kate and their daughters of Libertyville, Illinois, daughter Kristen Dodd and son Jackson of Plano, son Jordan Dodd and wife Emily and their children of San Angelo, sister Deborah Hart of Brownwood, as well as nephews and cousins. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to First Woodway Baptist Church, 101 North Ritchie Road, Waco, Texas, 76712, or to the American Heart Association. The family invites you to leave a message or memory on the tribute wall at www.whbfamily.com. Geneva Long Ridgeway. Geneva Long Ridgeway won her three-year fight against pancreatic cancer on February 13th in Midland. Geneva was born February 3rd, 1948, to Lorene and Jack Long in Gorman, Texas. Geneva is survived by the love of her life, husband Paul Ridgeway, son Brett Ridgeway and wife Lindsay of Midland, daughter Lacey Chester and husband Shannon of Old Hickory, Tennessee, five grandchildren, sister Lou Hitt and husband Roger, sister Sue Mercer and husband Clifford, sister-in-law Lynn Long, as well as numerous nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her parents, Jack Long and Lorene Rogers Ritchie, stepfathers Curly Rogers and Glenn Ritchie, and brother Wayne Long. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials be made to MD Anderson Cancer Center. Family will receive friends had a visitation on Tuesday, February 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Nally Pickle Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. on Wednesday, February 16th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Interment will follow at Resthaven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. George Eugene Powell. George Eugene Powell, May 15, 1938 to February 9, 2022. George Eugene Powell, Gene, to his family and friends, was called home February 9, 2022. He is preceded in death by Anita Sue, his wife of 62 years, his son Rodney, and daughter Annette. George is survived by his daughter Kathy, his son Roy, three grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren. Visitation will be 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Tuesday, February 15th at First Baptist Church in Round Rock, with funeral service to begin at 10 a.m. Interment will follow at Sunset Hill Cemetery, La Pryor, Texas. Robert Dean Conrad, Jr. Robert Dean Conrad, Jr. passed away Saturday, January 22nd. He was born in Omaha, Nebraska on November 20, 1957 to Robert Dean Sr. and Marilyn Conrad. Robert is preceded in death by his parents. He is survived by his wife Sherry, siblings Vicky Galvin, Kimberly Conrad, and Michaela Marty Armstrong, daughters Stacy, Victor Hutchinson, granddaughter Zoe, and many nephews, nieces, and cousins. Celebration of Life will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 19th at the branch at NPW. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. Benita O. Gonzalez. Benita O. Gonzalez, 88, of Midland, passed away February 12th. Celebration of Life will be held at 2 p.m. Sunday, February 20th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Alicia Evans. Alicia Evans, 101, of Odessa, passed away on February 7th. Visitation will be held on Thursday, February 17th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Funeral service will be on Friday, February 18th at 10 a.m. at Northside Church of Christ with Minister Rodney D. Taylor Sr. officiating. Interment will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Guadalupe Dominguez. Guadalupe Lupe Dominguez, 71, of Midland, passed away on Tuesday, February 8th. Funeral Mass is set for Tuesday, February 15th at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial will follow at American Heritage Cemetery. Arrangements were made with Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. Margarita Maggie Ortez. Margarita Maggie Ortez, 79, of Midland, died Friday, February 11th in Ardmore, Oklahoma. Final funeral services are pending. Harvey Douglas Funeral Home, Ardmore, Oklahoma, 580-223-2323. Maria Delfina Rutzan. Maria Delfina Rutzan, 84, of Midland, passed away peacefully in her home on February 11th. Family and friends will gather to celebrate her life at 10 a.m. Monday, February 14th at the Andrews Old Cemetery in Andrews, Texas. A visitation will be held Sunday, February 13th at the McNett Funeral Home Chapel from 5 to 7 p.m. Raymond Castillo. Raymond Castillo, 66, of Midland, passed away January 22nd. Professional services conducted by Ellis Funeral Home.
Hi, this is Kim. I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, February 15th, 2022. Abbott decries radical left agenda. Governor says his campaign is having unifying effect on GOP. Campaigning hard for a third four-year term, Governor Greg Abbott on Monday discounted the idea that the Republican Party is hopelessly factionalized by saying his candidacy is having a unifying effect. Abbott didn't directly answer when asked if he would be able to overcome intra-party dissension like the Ector County Republican Executive Committee's censure of him during the height of the pandemic for his mask mandates and the support by some committee members for his top two March 1st GOP primary opponents, Don Huffines and Alan West. In their efforts to rid the party of rhinos or Republican in name only, we're also seeing the way the Republican Party is coalescing with the support I'm getting from all sectors, he said. Texas was one of the first states to get back to business, and we have more job growth today than at any time in the history of our state. Referring to last spring's state legislative session in Austin, Abbott said, "We made sure that we had the most conservative session ever, with Republicans rallying around to support law enforcement, eliminate the teaching of critical race theory in our schools, and make sure we protected innocent lives and the Second Amendment." Texas is spending more than $3 billion to secure the border and build our own wall. Abbott encouraged an estimated crowd of 60 at the Cooper Rose Building downtown to vote during the early voting period that opened Monday and will run through February 23rd at the elections office in the County Administration Building at 1010 East 8th Street, the Elegante Hotel, the Globe Theater of the Great Southwest, Kellis Turner Community Center, and Salinas Community Building. Often mentioning Democratic gubernatorial candidate Robert Francis Beto O'Rourke of El Paso, but not Huffines or West, he said, "We cannot allow the radical leftist agenda to destroy energy jobs. I'm running for re-election to protect energy jobs right here in the Permian Basin. Texas ranks number one in the United States as the best state to start a new business in and the best state to do business in. More Texans have jobs now than ever in our history." Pausing to have photos taken with supporters in his Securing the Future of Texas campaign, before briefly taking questions from reporters, Abbott said, "We need to recognize that no government program can ever replace the role that parents play in the education of their children. That's why we need a parental bill of rights to restore parents as the decision makers for their children's educational and health care needs. The radical leftist agenda has the idiotic idea of defunding the police, which has led to chaos wherever it has taken place, as it did in Austin. We don't defund the police. We support law enforcement, and we passed a law to defund any city in Texas that defunds the police." Abbott said O'Rourke is an ardent opponent of the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, notwithstanding his recent waffling on the issue. O'Rourke always wants to eliminate tax exemptions for churches that refuse to bow down to his agenda, he said. "I will not let that happen in Texas." O'Rourke said last week in Tyler that he would not take away anyone's guns, but hell yeah, he is going to take your guns. You can't believe anything he says because he keeps changing his positions. I would like to see him come to Odessa and take a gun from anybody. Trustees to mull bond election order. The Ector County ISD Board of Trustees will consider adoption of an order calling for a bond election for May 7, 2022 at their 6 p.m. meeting Tuesday. The gathering will be held in the first floor boardroom of the administration building, 802 North Sam Houston Avenue. The bond package includes a new high school, career and technical education center, technology upgrades. The high school would be $183 million, the Career and Technical Education Center, $70 million, technology updates, $15 million, Priority 1 life cycle needs, $52.8 million, and Priority 2 life cycle needs, $122.3 million. Priority 1 are projects that should be addressed immediately in the next 1 to 2 years, the board recap said. Priority 2 are projects that should be addressed in the next 3 to 5 years. The Bond Advisory Committee recommended that the bond not exceed $400 million and that the election be held in May. The full recommendation from the committee exceeded the $400 million. With district leaders and an architect, trustees reviewed 3 different options for reducing the cost of the life cycle needs and overall cost of the bond package. The option the board was leaning toward was $398.2 million. Some of the other items on the agenda are discussion and request for approval of the 2022-2023 academic calendars, naming committee membership for Bonham Middle School football field, discussion of and request for approval of Board of Trustees recommendations for naming committee membership for Blackshear Elementary Auditorium. Special presentations include a donation from the Young Professionals of Odessa, Texas Music Educators Association All-State Musicians, recognition of Emerging Leader Academy completers, and introduction of Aspiring Principals Academy candidates. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County, 36,667 total cases, 643 deaths. Midland County, 36,228 total cases, 467 deaths. Texas, 6,517,733 total cases, 82,270 deaths. U.S. cases, 77,592,982 total confirmed and 916,977 deaths. Find out more at covidinthebasin.com or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/tztrjlf. See the ECISD COVID-19 dashboard at tinyurl.com/y6ntptuq. Medical Center Hospital, daily COVID inpatient numbers as of 8:30 a.m. Monday. 37 COVID patients in-house, med-surg non-critical, 28 COVID patients, critical care, 9 COVID patients, 6 unvaccinated, 3 vaccinated, 6 COVID patients on ventilator, 4 unvaccinated, 2 unvaccinated, age ranges of COVID patients, 30 years old, 289 years old. COVID patients from outside Ector County, 1 from Abilene, 1 from Big Lake, 4 from Fort Stockton, 1 from Gardendale, 1 from Goldsmith, 1 from Midland, 1 from Pecos. Free drive-through COVID-19 tests. The City of Odessa Incident Command is partnering with Curative to offer the COVID-19 PCR test drive-through from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday at the corner of 2nd Street and Grant Avenue. Insurance information will be requested. If no insurance, test will be free. To book an appointment, visit curative.com.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.